Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Shuttlepod at the Disco. This is our second episode of this special edition of the Shuttlepod, where we look back at episodes of Star Trek Discovery that have just aired. Today is Monday, October 2nd, and we are going to talk about the third episode of Star Trek Discovery, which aired yesterday, Sunday, October 1st. My name is Kaylee Iacovino, and I am joined by my co-host, Jared Whitley.
Good morning, Kayla.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. I'm excited that we have new content weekly to talk about.
Yeah, no kidding. This is a first in, you know, the history of a lot of Star Trek websites. Ours definitely, probably, I guess, were podcasts even around when Enterprise was on the air? If they were, they were really in their infancy.
Not really.
Yeah. So this is an exciting time to be a Trek fan.
Yeah,
for
it
sure.
Is good. Yeah, yeah. All other things being equal, if you like the show, if you hate the show, it is just nice to have new content like this.
Yeah, that's actually exactly what I was about to say. Like, it's a good precursor to our episode here. Is just, you know, I have to sometimes remind myself when I start to get really nitpicky or critical, which is fun, which we love to do as Trekkies.
yes, but I have to remind myself. The best part about loving. Oh.
Go ahead.
The best part about loving Star Trek is hating Star Trek.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to argue with that if you have ever been on the internet. but yeah, I just have to remind myself, like, hey, Kayla, there's Star Trek on TV right now. Like, this is a good time.
Yeah, this is what we've been complaining about for the last 10 years, is that there wasn't Star Trek on TV. And so now we're good.
Now we need something else to complain about.
Yes, we do. But something that I know you'll never complain about is the humans at Bye Bye Robot. Kayla, could you tell me a little more about them?
I sure could. As always, the Shuttlepod podcast is brought to you by the humans at Bye Bye Robot, purveyors of fine art from the future. Bye Bye Robot sells officially licensed Star Trek art made by multiple artists in many different styles at prices starting around $25. Go to byebyerobot.com to learn more.
Excellent. Byebyerobot.com. Okay, well, before we get into episode 3 of Discovery, I just wanted to talk a little bit about this new movie, American Made. Have you seen or heard of this, Kayla?
I've not. I've heard very little about it.
So it's basically this dramatized version of kind of the Iran-Contra affair in the 80s. Tom Cruise plays this pilot who basically gets hired by the CIA to run guns to these anti-communists, and there's a lot of, because it's in the 80s, they do some like little political jokes where they reference stuff that wouldn't have been a big deal then but would become a big deal later. Uh-huh. in America, for example, there, you know, the guy lives in Arkansas, and there's this very conspicuous scene where he's talking to a lawyer, and the lawyer gets a phone call from Bill Clinton, and, you know, mm-hmm. if Bill Clinton weren't going to become president, they wouldn't have mentioned it, but, you know, it's just a cute little thing.
That's
and
cool.
Then there's this there's this very conspicuous cameo by one Mr. Connor Trinneer, which is why I bring this up, who of course played Commander Tucker in Enterprise, and he's there with Tom Cruise in the White House, and I'm watching it and I'm thinking, that's cool to see Connor here, but why are they making a big deal about this little cameo? And then, you know, then you went back to the movie. When I got home, first thing I checked on Wikipedia was what he was doing in there, and apparently he was playing a young George W. Bush. And I read that and I think, well, now I just want to watch a movie with Connor Trinneer as young Bush.
Oh, my God. Totally. He would do that really well, actually.
He's so great at it. And you've met him. You've met him in person. You know, I'm sure he's even more charming in real life than he is two-dimensional. But I would love to see that movie. So if American Made performs well, please let's see the sequel, American Made 2, Commander Tucker as Bush.
I have to ask, was he affecting an accent in the scene?
No, he wasn't. He sounded exactly like Trip.
Okay, interesting.
Which made it odder, frankly.
But of course, we're here to talk about Discovery and the newest episode that just came out yesterday, titled Context is for Kings, written by Gretchen J. Berg and Aaron Harberts and Craig Sweeney, story by Brian Fuller and Gretchen J. Berg and Aaron Harberts, directed by Akiva Goldsman. And as this is still one of the earlier episodes, we've got a lot of ands in there as one of the first episodes of Discovery. And I think We're going to talk about a number of things related to episode three today, but I think something that's going to sort of umbrella this entire discussion is the fact that, and I think you'll agree with me on this one, Jared, episode three was the pilot.
Yes, it was. To the point where I think they should have just started with this as the pilot, and then everything we saw as the first two episodes should have been flashbacks interspersed throughout the first season.
Because that's like the more classic approach they would have taken. And I don't have any problem with the way they did it. I think the only thing I kind of like, honestly, that they switched it up a bit. We got the episodes one and two, which were basically a prologue. And then, you know, chapter one, the pilot, is episode three. And, you know, yeah, in a normal setting, you would have done a pilot where you do all the things a pilot needs to do. You introduce the characters, you introduce the setting, you know, USS Discovery, you introduce what's going to be the story arc for the rest of the season. And, it, you know, episodes one and two then would have been thrown in, like you said, as flashbacks to remind us where a character came from. But I think it's like, I don't know, I'm kind of liking what they did with it in this case, where
Oh, really?
They gave us all that background information, so when we first meet our character, you know, because she, at the beginning of episode three, Burnham is beyond down in the dumps. I mean, she's, you know, she's resigned to die at the beginning of this episode. And it gives us a little bit of context for understanding why with episodes one and two, and it also gives us context for understanding why her meeting people like Saru and other people on the Discovery was such an emotional, like a mixed emotion moment for her. So it gives those a little bit more weight right off the bat, whereas I feel like you wouldn't have felt that weight until like a second or third watch, you know what I mean, through the series.
Okay, all right, I could see that. It just felt like when I was watching it yesterday and you're meeting the characters who you know are going to be around, then I felt like, aha, here we go. Aha, this is great, right? Which, you, given that we knew that Michelle Yao was a dead captain walking, it was very difficult to feel that.
Yeah, it's true. And, like, you know, we didn't see the titular ship of the entire series until episode three, so...
Yeah. And let me tell you, those glory shots where they introduce the ship are really beautiful.
Yeah, maybe my favorite moment of this episode actually was when you first see the Discovery, because it looks gorgeous.
Yeah, it does. It does. There's a part of the design which makes no sense, where it's kind of like a donut with a hole in the middle.
Yeah, but it looks cool anyway.
It looks cool. You know, it kind of looks like a Rings of Saturn thing. But in terms of structural integrity of a ship, that makes absolutely no sense to do that.
Maybe you could throw in some like arm wavy techno babble about why it's actually better because of the shape of the warp bubble or some such nonsense.
Oh, okay.
We could come up with something.
I'm sure we could. Maybe it's so they can do a double saucer separation.
Oh my God, they should do that. Actually, they shouldn't, but I like to imagine them doing it.
Well, you really turned on a dime there, Kayla.
I mean, they shouldn't actually do it because it would be pretty lame, I think. But
yeah, it would.
But I want to see it anyway.
Yeah. Something else, if I can touch on the design of the ship while we're there. Mm. I think they do a good job of, in terms of continuity, of making it feel kind of like New Trek in terms of the visuals. And something that the New Trek Enterprise did is the view screen was both the view screen and a windshield.
Yeah.
And they did that with the Discovery as well. And so I thought that was a nice little continuity touch.
Which also feels like such an obvious thing to have in, I mean, talk about design that makes sense. That just seems really obvious. Like, you would want that on a starship. And you would want a view screen that wraps around like the entire bridge too.
Yep. Yeah, if in case there's a power outage or a smudge right? on the camera, you want to be able to look out where you're going. Because the only actual window on the Enterprise historically had been the Oculus in the ceiling, right?
Right.
And that's not as useful.
All right, so let's break this down a bit and talk about let's start with the characters. We got one of the things the pilot has to do is introduce all the characters that we're going to be living with for the rest of this series.
Mm-hmm.
And episode three is where that all happened for us. So we met Lorca, we met Stamets, we met Cadet Tilly, and we met Commander Landry. So they're all very, very different characters with really interesting interactions. Who was the standout for you?
I don't know. I thought Lorca was great, and I thought Tilly was great. I thought Commander Landry, the whole, I mean, 'cause she was on Battlestar Galactica, and so it was fun to see her back. I thought I liked some of the lines Stamets had. I loved when he called her a temp. I thought that was funny. So I enjoyed all of them, to be honest. It was a joy to meet these new friends that we're going to have some adventures with.
Yeah, I think for me, Tilly was probably the standout. She seems to me the most unique character, and I love that they
Definitely.
threw in this like bubbly, awkward, goofy girl who kind of doesn't know. She's like in over her head, but she's like, and she's super sweet, but she's not stupid. Like she knows what's up.
No.
She's just really, really green.
Exactly.
And she's like, I love when she has that conversation with Michael Burnham after, I think they're sitting on the shuttle together after Tilly had sort of been like, "Oh, you can't stand next to me at this terminal." Later, she's like, "Yeah, I lied. Like I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have done that." And Burnham is like, "Oh, that's okay." And she's like, "No, it's not okay. I shouldn't have done that." And that was like really cool of her. Showed her gave her a little more dimension, I thought.
So I also liked with that how she mentions there's assigned seating in the lab, right? And then a few minutes later, Stamets says, "Come on, it's not like there's assigned seating here."
Ooh. Awkward for Tilly. Lorca, I think, was probably my second favorite of the characters we met. I liked all of them, but they just were the two main standouts for me. He was more, I don't want to call him mustache twirling because he's not necessarily evil, right? But he's very mysterious. And there are things about him that if he were like a Bond villain, these would be perfect characteristics. Like the thing with his eyes, where he's like, "Oh, I had a recent battle injury. I can't withstand sudden changes in light, so I have to keep the light levels low." And he like never leaves his office, except for that site-to-site transport. Like those are very, that reminded me very much of like a Bond villain.
Oh, sure. See, and it's kind of okay, there's in King Henry V, right? And then of course I only know this because they Picard and Data do it on the episode The Defector, right? There's this scene where before the battle King Henry disguises himself and goes and walks among his men to show, and you know, that's Shakespeare's way of showing this is a good guy. He fights with his men. He doesn't think he's above them. Commander Lorca is kind of the opposite of that, where he refuses to walk amongst his crew, right? To the point where he'll actually beam within the ship to avoid having to mingle with people.
And does that have to do with his eye problem? Or, I mean, I don't think so, right? He's
I
just.
don't think so.
So we
I don't
don't
think
really
so.
know why he's doing that at this point.
Also, I think the eye thing is less meant to be like an actual character point physically, and more meant to be seen metaphorically, right? Because the idea is he sees the universe more darkly than our other captains have.
Ooh, love it. Yeah, and that's a good, also a good way to wedge it into contrasting it with the existing canon, the existing Star Trek canon.
I appreciated when he talked about that he said, they say I have to do this if I want to keep my original eyes, instead of saying, "Oh, plus I'm allergic to Retinox 5."
I do
Would have
like
been
that
lame.
he had chosen to keep his original eyes.
Yes.
Although I guess
Yes.
if continuity is if we're going to assume technological continuity, which we kind of can't in a lot of ways, then
Well.
you know even 100 years from the time this of the time of Lorca, you know when Geordi has the visor, his vision is kind of crap, right? Like he still can't see the world the way humans do. That's 100 years later. So maybe Lorca's option for eye replacement is not so great.
It could be. It could be. They're definitely, and we'll get to this later, but they're playing a little fast and loose with the technology.
That's definitely something we need to touch on.
Anything else about the characters? I do want to say one thing about Saru. I saw one article that my phone recommended I read in my little news feed that said Saru is the most divisive new character of Discovery. He's the Jar Jar Binks of Star Wars.
What?
And I think that is just total balls.
Yeah, no.
I think Saru is great. I love seeing him on screen. That actor has such a wonderful way of being alien and personable at the same time. I like that he is an unusual alien size, right? that he's, you know, he's got those weird legs that make him taller than everybody. And I like that he is compassionate to Burnham in that scene where he compassionate and while also scornful at the same time. Right. So I like everything about Saru.
Yeah, I Saru is probably my favorite character, even above Burnham at this point, to be honest.
Oh, completely. Yeah. I am kind of struggling with Burnham.
A lot of people are.
Yeah.
And I think I wouldn't have even said that until I heard other people say, oh, I don't know if I like her very much. And I'm like, really, why not? And I guess I had just, I don't, you know, I'm not in love with Burnham yet. I wouldn't say I'm quite struggling, but I guess I just keep assuming that she's going to get to a place where I'll like understand her better and really connect with her a lot more.
Yeah. Something that I think might be the problem is you mentioned all these ands in the uh-huh. writing. And I think, you know, Brian Fuller created this character. He had some kind of vision for her, and he's not the one implementing her.
Yeah.
And I think that may be the problem. I mean, like, I don't understand why they did all the, they have the Vulcan stuff with her. I just don't understand it at all. I thought the scene where she, like, outwitted the monster was great, but I didn't understand why she started quoting Alice in Wonderland. Like, I just thought
well, that, they that, bring that, it home later when they say that Amanda, you know, read that book to her when she was young.
Sure, sure. But I think it would have been better for her to just, like, do an Alice name drop type of thing rather than,
yeah,
like,
I agree.
Reciting a book to herself.
It was a little heavy, heavy-handed and bizarre. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
So let's actually break it down. Like, let's, like, what actually happened in this episode? So we've touched on it a little bit, but maybe we can go through and actually discuss sort of in two different ways what happened in this episode. A, like, what events actually took place, and then B, what was the episode actually about? But okay. First, let's maybe talk about like each of the things that happens in this episode, and we can touch on each of those a bit.
Okay. So first of all, the episode started as an episode of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
With her on that prison shuttle.
Uh-huh.
And like those prisoners, like, you know, being all gruff and everything. I'm like, okay, we're back on the Galactica.
Yeah.
And then Commander Landry shows up, and I'm like, okay, all right, what's going on here?
Yeah, and she was just a peach. Jeez, I was like, they want us to hate her, quite obviously.
Yeah,
and it's working because when she's uh-huh. like, what was it that she said? Oh, I see they're delivering trash today or something. And I'm like, Jesus,
oh, come on,
what happened to like 23rd century like our evolved sensibility? Like, shouldn't we treat prisoners better than that? They're still people.
Or just not be a douchebag.
Or just, yeah, right? just follow Wheaton's law and just don't be a dick.
There we go.
But yeah, they very clearly want us to hate her, and I definitely mm-hmm. hate her.
Yeah, and they did, and she's the, of the new characters, she's the one who didn't have any other real moments, and so she didn't have any, like Stamets gets kind of angry at her, but we see him enough that we understand why he's angry with her, and why he calls her a temp or whatever, but... So we see all of him, but here we just see her being a bully.
Yeah, pretty much. And we see her later at the very end, which we can talk about too. So they're on the shuttle, and basically the shuttle's about to crash and they're all about to die. And this is a really important setup, I think, for Burnham, because like I mentioned earlier, at this point, we know what Burnham's been through and we can understand why she's basically resigned to die. You know, everyone else is screaming and like, oh my God, what are we going to do? The pilot's gone. And she's just sitting there like, you know, whatever. I don't care. Like, her life was crap. She was hating herself, and she didn't care if she died at that point. So that's mm-hmm. where we start. That's where, you know, again, going on the sort of thesis that this is the pilot, that's basically how we meet Michael, is mm-hmm. she's ready to die. Then they board the Discovery. We meet the amicable Commander Landry. I think we get introduced to Tilly pretty shortly thereafter.
Sure, because they're roommates.
Because they're roommates, and that was a great moment. And as soon as she was on the screen, her first couple of lines, I was like, yes, I love her.
Yeah, yeah, and she feels different, right? She doesn't feel like any other character on Star Trek.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I wouldn't know who to compare her to in all of Trek, I think.
There is an episode of Deep Space Nine where Jake and Nog are on this cadet ship, and there's this redheaded cadet who is a little lacking self-confident, who kind of reminded me of this character. But I think that might just be a coincidence. The thing is, when you have 700, 800 hours of canonical material,
right,
some stuff is just a coincidence.
Yeah. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
There we go. Which was mentioned in that episode with the cellular peptide cake.
Nice. I couldn't remember which episode, but I knew it was from Trek.
And I'm embarrassed. I can't remember the name. Please put it in the comment section below. Anyway, I'm interrupting you. Keep going.
Okay, then we meet Commander Lorca and his mysterious ready room with his very cool standing desk and Tribble companion. And some backstory about fortune cookies, which I guess I'm okay with. It was a little jarring for me at first to see bowl of fortune cookies, but...
Yeah, I think it was to reinforce the idea that he's a little unlike other captains, to show that he's maybe a little superstitious.
Ooh, right? I like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. I like this, I'm rethinking a lot of the Lorca stuff now, talking to you, and you're like, oh, this represents how he's different from other captains this way.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, you're right. They actually were pretty clearly doing that, weren't they? They were like, this isn't your father's Star Trek.
No. And you see, they kind of did the same thing when Q appears in an early episode of Deep Space Nine and he's facing off against Sisko. There's Q's like mocking him, making fun of him, and Sisko just punches him. And he says, oh, Picard never hit me. And he says, yeah. I'm not Picard, right? And that was very literally heavy-handed the way they did that. And here they're doing it, but they're doing it more, yeah, thank you. But they're doing it a little more artfully.
Yeah, and I love that you point out that like other series have done this as well. I think each of the Star Trek series has had to try and set itself apart from the others, because otherwise what's the point of a new series, right?
Sure.
And so a lot of people will probably complain about this being too different, but at the same time, you don't want more of the same. You really don't. You think you do, but you don't. You know what I mean? I have to remind myself of that.
And managing to do the same but different is very difficult.
Yeah.
Okay, so then she meets Lorca, she meets Tilly, she gets her room, she gets her job where she's in the astromycology lab. Then they learned that their sister ship, the Glenn, presumably named after John Glenn, has been damaged, and they need to go to a rescue mission. They basically recreate a scene from the video game Doom where they have to fight a monster. We see that Michael Burnham is very clever, and she uses the Jeffries tubes or air ducts or whatever they are to sort of outmaneuver the monster.
Mm-hmm.
If I understood it correctly.
Yeah.
And then they capture it or incapacitate it.
They escape at this point, right? And they leave it at this point in the plot. As far as we know, they've just left it on the ship.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. And
that's,
I think,
right, that's right.
I think that's what you bring up with Michael is an important part. It's like, again, for like, because really this episode to me is completely a character arc. It's 100% about characters and 1%, or 99% about characters and 1% about plot.
Sure.
And here, this is the point where Burnham is, she's kind of reintroduced to her old friend. She's tried to say sorry in an awkward way, kind of tried to start making her peace with Saru. And this moment is when you see her like start to turn things around. So she finally has some motivation to help, to try to do something. She's like, you guys go, like, I'm gonna do this. And it's not out of because I'm okay with dying thing. It's not like I'll just be here as bait and you go, you know, it's like, I have a plan. I'm gonna, like, I'm putting my mind to use. I feel useful again. I feel a need to help with this mission. So I think that, I feel like for me, that scene is the turning point for Burnham, at least in this episode.
Yeah. I thought that was good, except for the Alice in Wonderland stuff, which I thought was distracting, as I mentioned. I think it's a little weird that they keep like talking about how great Michael is, like Saru's saying, like, she's the smartest Starfleet officer I've ever seen. It's like, you need to show that kind of thing, you need to not tell it. And the more you say it, it's like you have a lack of confidence in your main character. Like when in the movie Iron Man, they don't say Iron Man is so cool, he's like a rock star. They just let Robert Downey Jr. show you that he's a rock star. Right?
Yeah.
So they need to kind of ease back the Mary Sewage a little bit and just let Michael be Michael.
I guess so. I would I kind of appreciated that Saru moment because I was like, when we first meet back up with Saru on Discovery, like, I was mad at him. I'm like, bro, why are you being so harsh on her? Like, you were there. Mm-hmm. You saw what happened. And he's just like, yeah. You are dangerous and I don't want you on the ship, basically. And it's like, you know how she must be, like, killing herself and devastated. And you know what she did wasn't out of malice. I was, like, kind of mad at him.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Yeah. The absence of malice.
Yeah, yeah. And then, like, he saw what happened. So he knows that it's not just black and white. You know, she made a mistake. She clearly did something wrong, but it's not totally black and white. And so later when he does that, in that scene where he says to the captain, like, basically, she should go on this mission. She's the smartest, you know, Starfleet officer I've ever met. Mm-hmm. That's like, I feel like that's Saru's way of giving Michael Burnham a pep talk. You know?
Oh.
You know, that's like his, yeah, okay. his right. way of showing support for her.
Yeah.
And that's where things turn around. And I'm like, okay, I'm less mad at you now, but I'm still kind of mad at you.
Still kind of.
Still kind of a little bit. But he's coming around. I feel like he's going to be a big ally for her.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, he will.
Yeah.
All right, okay, good point. Okay, then they flee the Glen. They have to destroy the Glen, but we learn that Captain Lorca has done something mysterious.
Yeah, and this is when Lorca gets super weird, and yeah. Lorca and Landry have their very interesting moment.
Oh, I'm sorry, we skipped over the research. He shows
Oh, of course.
He shows
yeah.
Michael about their mysterious research.
Yeah. Which is kind of the main part of the episode in terms yeah. of like what's going to happen going forward. It's like a big part of this, right? So they yeah. are, as we had sort of been guessing for months, just based on the, because, you know, you and I and the other members of Trek Movie, we've been like way deep in Discovery for over sure. a year now. And so based on all the stuff we'd known, we gleaned that they were going to develop a quote unquote new way to fly, aka like new warp type technology using yeah. Stamets's space mushrooms.
Sure.
And that's basically
because at the quantum level, biology and physics are the same thing.
It's what is it? It's physics as biology. Are you so naive and to think that they're different? I was like, dude, get a hold of yourself, bro. He is so pretentious.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of like that part about him, though.
Yeah, I do, too, because it makes him interesting. But he is such a, as a scientist myself, like, I know yes. scientists like him. And it's always like, you know, they're usually the kind of scientist that thinks that because they can write PhD after their name, it means they're the smartest person yeah. in the room. And it's yeah, like, it yeah, doesn't. Yeah. And if you believe that, it means you're probably one of the dumber people in the room.
Oh, take that, other scientists.
Because well, you can't, you have to be humble when you're doing science, because if you're collecting real data, you know, it's not always going to agree with your hypothesis. And so yeah. you can't be big headed about it. You can't have an ego.
Sure.
Because you have to listen to the data as they lie.
Yeah. Yeah. Sir Isaac Newton discovered calculus. He did not invent it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so yeah. So Stamets, our big pretentious guy. I know I'm gonna grow to love him eventually, but for now he's kind of a jerk.
Only kind of, though. Also, his best friend just got killed, so kind of.
Yeah, but I mean, he was a jerk before that too. Before his touche. Friend died, so he's just okay. a jerky guy.
Yeah. Okay, so he shows her the mysterious research. We have a sequence where she gets beamed to a bunch of different planets and then brought back. And it's kind of awe-inspiring.
Well,
we
need to talk about this a little more, I think. It's just that I'm curious about what actually happened in the in Lorca's gas chamber, as I'll call it. Because he's like, go in the gas chamber. I'm going to put these sparkly fungi around you. And then he said something about like the memory of the fungus, right? About where they've been and where they're going to go or something like that. And then she sees all these places. So I'm not clear that she was actually going to those places or if she was just seeing sort of the memory of this, what was it, the mycelial network?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe she's just seeing the places that she could go because she can like see into this network. You know, so I wasn't clear what actually happened. I don't know what you thought of when, if she was actually transporting to those places or what?
Oh, I had no reason to not take it at face value. But now I don't.
Yeah, I feel like they didn't explain it. And I think that was probably on purpose that we'll get more mm-hmm. of it. Because he was just like, let me just show you this magic trick, basically.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll see what happens with this magic new technology that we know does not exist in the rest of the franchise's history.
That we know can't work because it would utterly destroy Star Trek canon and remove the need for exploratory vessels.
Yeah, kind of like they did in Into Darkness as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, way to just completely undo the entire need for Starfleet.
Yeah.
So we know that this technology can't work. There has to be something about it that either the price you pay to use it is too large, or they just never can get it to work or something. Because it just doesn't make sense with the rest of canon. And it's been said officially that this is the prime timeline. This is a prequel.
Yep.
So I don't know. I'm a bit confused about that, but I have to admit that we don't have very much information. And so I'm happy to wait a little bit longer, you know, to learn more.
Okay.
But it is very much like, oh, what are you doing? I have to know.
Mm-hmm. Well, do we want to talk a little bit more about context within the franchise? Do you want to transition into that?
Yeah, I think we should.
Okay, so we have some top-level questions here. What's your biggest question, Kayla?
In terms of how does this fit into the context of the franchise?
Yes, given that we know that context is for kings.
Context is for kings. And yet,
it is.
And yet, I feel like we need a lot more context in order to really talk about episode 3.
Yeah, we do.
Because it really just lays out a lot of facts and it doesn't give us a lot of meat to chew on yet. But for me, it's the tone.
Okay.
You know, this, after watching this episode, I felt like that was very dark. Like, really, really dark. You know, we had, and a lot of it too was like, my friend was commenting like, wow, you know, when I was a kid, I was like 4 or 5 watching Star Trek. I would not let my 4 or 5-year-old watch this.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. We would all watch Next Generation on Sunday evenings as a family.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we would necessarily watch this.
No, it's not really appropriate. And not with the gore and the faces contorted. Like, it was scary. It was legit scary.
Yeah.
The scene on the Glen.
Yeah. So, yeah. That was kind of weird. That was.
I'm not.
Like I say, it reminded me of the video game Doom more than Star Trek.
Yeah. I'm not necessarily disappointed that it's more geared toward adults, because I am an adult and I can appreciate that, but I am saddened that there's this possibility that the very youngest generation will maybe miss out on this until they're a bit older.
Sure.
Just feels a little bit less inclusive, but at the same time, you know, you can't make a show for everyone.
That's true.
So
yeah, and that's no longer a goal of modern media, right?
It
used to be a TV show for the whole family, and now that's not the goal.
That's not prime time television where the whole family can sit down over dinner and watch a show. That's not what sells the most ad slots, I guess, anymore.
Exactly. In terms of tone, one line that I really liked is when Lorca is eating the fortune cookies, and he says, you know, this was a family business before we got rid of hunger and want 100 years ago, but now they're making a comeback, right? So that line is how they're showing, okay, this is in the Star Trek franchise of being hopeful and optimistic, but we have this little sliver where there's all this conflict.
Yeah, I have to say that was a little bit disappointing for me, because I'm not, like, even DS9 was like too war heavy for me, and that's still pretty darn optimistic. I mean, I love DS9. It's just like I say this all the time. I'm a TNG baby. I like my Trek. I'm used to my Trek being ridiculously optimistic, like to a fault.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
You know, and this doesn't have to be that, but there's still like, I feel like there's this hole in my heart that is yearning for that level of optimism, and just like I want the escapism. I want to turn on Star Trek and forget about the rest of the world and forget about the wars going on and the hate, and just be like, everything's gonna be okay. It's gonna be okay.
Yeah.
People are good. Humanity is good.
Yeah.
You know? And I feel like I haven't gotten that yet, but the more I reflect on this episode, the more I'm willing to, and I mean, not saying I was gonna quit watching it anyway, but the more I'm willing to sort of wait for that, because I feel like if you do take a look at, like I said, I feel like this episode was about Michael Burnham's character development. And so if you look at the context in the episode in that context, then she really went through a pretty extreme arc. She went from being ready to die to being ready to be part of something again, to be a part of the ship.
Okay.
And yes, there's a lot of dark themes to it. You don't know exactly the reasons that, you know, what's she going to get herself involved in. It's not like, oh yeah, let's go exploring again. It's like, okay, well, let's work on this top secret, like, you know, Section 31 type black ops ship doing secret war stuff. But she's not ready to die anymore. And so her character is like, you know, if you could imagine that her trajectory will continue in that way, maybe she'll get to the point where she's strong enough again. She's regained her confidence. She's regained her own optimism. And like, that's just what I'm hoping for, is that we'll be able to follow along with her and that they're playing the long game here, where by halfway through the season or towards the end of the season, we're like with her. We're like, yeah, like, you've come back from this. We're optimistic with you. You need to do the right thing. Like, it's all up to you, Michael, to do the right thing. Kind of, you know, that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
Sure. Yeah, I will say, to return to what you said earlier, this is why the Tilly character is so important, is because she's the spoonful of sugar that makes the medicine of the rest of the episode go down, right?
Oh, good one. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. If it weren't for her bright spot, I think someone who comes at it with the perspective you're describing wouldn't find any access to this episode at all. It would just all be people shouting at each other and shooting each other.
Yeah. Well, in the first three episodes of this television show, we've had like a few moments of levity. There was one or two in the first two episodes, and then there was Tilly in episode three. That's like the only levity we got.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So in terms of tone, is there anything else we want to say?
You know, for me, that's the main part. Just like, this is super dark, but I think they're certainly playing the long game with these characters. So
yeah,
I think we'll see the tone evolve as well.
So in terms of the tone, the thing that I kept wanting, and as well as like the action and some of the visuals, and then like these canonical issues, which are unavoidable, right? I kept watching it and I enjoyed it and I felt very engaged in it, right? Like I find myself frequently when I consume media content, I just turn it on while I do something else and I don't really watch it. But with this, I really wanted to watch every moment of it. But the thing I kept wondering is, why isn't this just its whole own thing? Why the same way, like, there's this show Black Mirror, which they describe as the Twilight Zone for the digital age, rather than saying, oh, we're just doing the Twilight Zone again. Why don't they say, this is Star Trek for the 21st century, right? It's in the same vein, like inspired by, but it's its whole own separate thing, right? Because not even is there just some of the tonal issues that maybe some fans may find inconsistent, or, you know, introducing a new technology which we know cannot work because otherwise we would have seen everyone else use it.
Right.
We also have, like, they keep, and this will get into a little bit to our fan service, they keep name dropping like aliens or planets that were meant to say, aha, there we go. But then, like, visually, there's these aliens in the background that we've never seen before, right? They keep mentioning Andorians and Tellarites, but they haven't shown a single one. They keep showing these like Star Wars aliens in the background.
Yeah.
So it's like one of the advantages the Orville has, where if it makes a reference to Star Trek, it's cute, but it's entirely free to be its own thing.
But it's clearly TNG.
Clearly. It's clearly TNG fan fiction.
Which is kind of awesome. I don't mind watching like TNG fan fiction made into something with a real budget. It's kind of neat.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. I think that's actually, maybe it's a good thing that you mentioned the Orville, because I think there could be a spectrum, right? This could very easily have been Star Trek fan fiction. And it's not. It's clearly not Discovery.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a good thing. I don't think we want Star Trek fan fiction for Trek. You know, for Orville, it's fun, it's cute, it's a romp. But, you know, for me, in my personal opinion, if we're going to make a new Trek series, we should make a new Trek series. And so I'm all for it being different, having a different tone, having different types of characters, different things. But, you know, I would be lying if I said that thought, you know, why is this Star Trek, why isn't this its own thing, didn't cross my mind. But at the same time, I think it's, I don't have a problem with it being Star Trek. I mean, at the end of the day, it is Star Trek, you know, no matter what we say, it is Star Trek, and it does fit pretty well. I mean, yes, there are glaring issues that we could bring up, but to be fair, that could be patched up later. But some of them that can't, like the hologram technology, like that was something they introduced in an episode of Deep Space Nine. And that was like this brand new, newfangled thing at that time. So like that's canonically wrong. But there are, you have to make exceptions for the fact that it's 2017 and we're making a television show based on a 1966 show. Like we can't, if we made something that looked like anything from the TNG era or even Enterprise or certainly TOS, it wouldn't look futuristic. No. You wouldn't believe that this was the 23rd century. It wouldn't be interesting in that way. And so I'm okay with those kinds of things if they're sort of few and if they're necessary. And I think like the hologram thing is kind of maybe necessary. So, you know, I don't have a problem with it. When you say, why is this Star Trek? Like I said, I think it's totally valid to ask that question. And it's, I've asked myself because that's, you know, what I do. But I'm happy with it being Star Trek. I think it actually, for the majority of ways, fits into canon relatively nicely.
Okay. And given that, you know, they have access to Memory Alpha, which the TNG writers did not have.
Right.
They have a huge edge. And you can tell that they're using it, which I appreciate.
Yeah. They also have maybe more of a burden because everyone else has access to Memory Alpha
everyone
as well.
Else does. Good point. Yeah, that's true. It's an arms race in fans versus creators. Let's see. What else did I want to say? In terms of it fitting in within the larger franchise, I think I mentioned this before. I really just don't get the that Burnham was raised by Vulcans. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Hmm.
And the Klingons, I still just wish the Klingons were their own kind of different monster race.
Hmm.
And I understand like they feel like those are the two most famous alien races, so we need to mention them. We just have to have them in there. But just within the story, they don't seem to fit. They feel crammed in there.
Hmm.
And then even in terms of it not feeling exactly right, like, I enjoy the main title sequence, and at the end when they play the little Star Trek fanfare, it just feels out of place to me. It feels very like tacked on.
Yeah, well, it kind of is.
Oh, okay, that's why. Oh, so I'm exactly.
I mean, don't you think? I mean, it's just they literally wrote a theme, and then at the end it just goes dun da dun dun da 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 da.
Yeah.
Like it, but whatever. I don't know. I agree with you 100% that it's tacked on, but I guess I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
Because I like that little fanfare.
It is, yes. It's nice to hear. Although the 2009 JJ movie, when they, you know, they don't play the fanfare at all throughout the entire film until the very end.
Yeah, it's like end credits. Yeah.
And that lands, right? That was done perfectly. When you hear that, it's like, oh, we've earned it. Now he's the captain. Now we've earned this beautiful song.
Nice.
In this adventure. And in a way that it doesn't feel like it fits here. Different context, of course. Okay, now let me ask you this question. How would you feel about this in terms of everything we've described if this were it's set in post-Nemesis, right?
Yeah.
Or post-2009. Let's say this is in the prime timeline, but it's after Romulus has been exploded and Ambassador Spock has disappeared into the Kelvin timeline. Would it feel better then than it would as something that's 10 years before Kirk and Spock?
I think in a lot of ways the writers would have made it easier on themselves if they had done that. If they had said this is not a prequel, this is a sequel. Because then the future is completely open and they're not constrained by these things of, oh, we know your mushroom drive ain't going to work because it doesn't show up later. And we know you're sticking to canon, at least for things like that big. But in a lot of ways, it might have made it harder for them because really, like, by the time you're post-Nemesis, you're like there's nothing left to do, right? I mean, unless there's some big catastrophe that sets the Federation back or there's a huge, I don't know, plague or war or something.
Sure.
You know, everything's fine. Everything's perfect. Everyone's happy. Everyone has food. There's no war. There's no call. You know what I mean? Like, we have every technology you can imagine, and we can beam people everywhere. We can go at a zillion, warp a zillion, and we can get, you know what I mean? You can, all the technology has been taken from the TNG era. And instead of like adding, you know, it's like when TNG started, they added like, you know, things like the holodeck and things like, you know, well, I mean, we had heard about it before then, but you know what I mean? We really saw the holodeck, and we saw like the Elkar system, and we saw these other things that were like, wow, like these are really advanced. And from that point forward, they just took all of those things and just like, but now they go to 11, you know, now the holodeck goes to 11, and now the warp goes to 11 and everything. And so it's like, where do you go from there? So I think it might've actually been harder to write an actual sequel. And I think I'm wondering if that's why they chose this era, because it's still familiar.
Certainly.
And it still gives you opportunities where like the Federation still has problems and there's still things to work out, and the technology can't just get you out of any jam.
Uh-huh.
You know, because it's not there yet.
Sure. And I mean, that was the same rationale for Enterprise as the original prequel, right?
Right. Which I don't know. I think it makes sense to me. If you really think about, okay, I'm sitting down with a piece of paper and a pencil. I'm going to write episode one of my Star Trek sequel. You know what I mean? Like, what do you write about?
Yeah. What you could say is after the destruction of Romulus, say that destabilized the quadrant, right?
Yeah, you have to have some huge event. And they could have done that. They could have been like, oh, there's a big intergalactic war and now things are hard. But that you still can't get around the fact that the technology is all there. It's super advanced.
Yeah. Yeah, especially like the stuff that I think Matt pointed out last episode, the stuff that Voyager brought home from the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah, Matt made that point really well last time, which totally, I'm probably just parroting what he was saying, but I'm totally on board with that idea at this point.
And like the whole reason they introduced the Borg in season two of TNG is they realized they'd made the crew so powerful, like they needed a completely new threat to enemy to threaten them.
Yeah.
But then by Voyager, it's like, all the times they've fought the Borg, it's like, we're 10-0, baby.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Even they're not a threat.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, once the raison d'etre of the Borg became to take over and enslave humanity, then you can't let them ever win because that would be the end.
Yeah. It's not.
I think of this whenever I think of this, I call it in my own mind, I call it the Superman problem. Because, you know, they made Superman, like, such a powerful being. Yeah. He could fly. He has super strength. He can go fast enough to turn back time. He can blah, blah, blah. Sure. He can do anything. So then it's like, okay, well, then what? There's no conflict.
Yeah. And thus we see why Batman and Spider-Man are more popular than Superman.
Oh, I love Superman, though. I love Superman because he's insanely optimistic. Just like TNG.
Of course he is. And in fact, it's interesting you mention this. I've been meaning to drop this for a while. There's this scene in Superman 2 where he's like about to fly off and to fight the evil Kryptonians. And he pauses to say, excuse me, to a random citizen of Metropolis on the ground. Because he's so polite that even in the middle of a battle with supervillains, he remembers his manners. And the thing that always reminds me of is in First Contact, where Data first meets Lily. And she like literally shoots him in the back with a machine gun. And he looks at her and says, greetings.
Greetings, yeah.
Because he's so polite.
That's awesome.
I felt appropriate to drop that in there. I don't know if we can expect that from the crew of the Discovery, that level of courtesy.
I'd like to think that we could get there. Maybe Tilly would be.
Maybe Tilly.
Hopefully she doesn't just get jaded.
She can. Oh, yeah.
She can anchor Burnham. She can remind Burnham. Yeah. And she'll be like, maybe Tilly will like start to slip and start to become more jaded and like doing things, you know, cutting corners or whatever. And Bernal will be like, no, you were right before. Like, you need to stay strong and keep to your values. I don't know. I'm just throwing shit out there.
Could be. Now, here's the thing that I wonder now that you mentioned this, and we'll use this to transition into talking about fan service. But Jonathan Frakes let it slip that this season will reintroduce the mirror universe.
Yes.
And how the crap is the mirror universe going to hold up to this?
It's going to be the good universe. They'll be like, oh shit, we've been in the wrong universe.
Exactly. Like, like Captain Lorca is this boss who brings baked goods to everyone every morning and is friendly. And he instead of a goatee, he has just really long sideburns or something.
Yeah. Oh my God. Wow, I'm looking forward to this episode.
Yeah, it'll be weird. Okay, but so we'll get to that when it comes. But let's talk a little bit more about fan service in general. Were there any like little winks and nods to the franchise that you noticed, Kayla?
There were a lot in this episode, but to be fair, that there still weren't so many that it bothered me, I guess. Because in episodes 1 and 2, there was like, it was really, really good in terms of not like, hey, remember Blue Milk?
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
But this time there were a little bit more, but I'm still fine with it. But, you know, we had the Tribble on Lorca's desk purring away.
Yeah, I liked the purring. I did like that.
I did like that too. And it almost gave him, there's more of his Bond villain, you know, like the cat, stroking the cat.
Oh,
instead, he's got the Tribble.
Yeah, perfect.
But then, yeah, when Burnham goes into the gas chamber, she sees, she sees the obelisk. What else does she see? There's a few things that she sees, right, when she's transporting around that are very clearly nods to like TOS and TOG episodes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, and the one I liked the best, this is, and I love this, is what's his name? Matt had made a comparison, I believe, last time to Burnham and Ensign Roe in terms of they're both capable officers who thought they could break the rules. Other people ended up suffering the consequences for it, and now they have the chance to redeem themselves. There's an actual when we see Michael on the Discovery, or the shuttle, I can't remember which, she directly quotes Ensign Roe from the episode where we first meet her. Huh. And it may have just been a coincidence, but when Ensign Roe is meeting Guinan, she says, oh, this sounds like the beginning of an interesting friendship. And Roe says, I don't stay anywhere long enough to make friends.
Right.
And Michael says the same thing.
That's awesome. I love it.
Yeah. It may be coincidence, but if there is a connection between those two, then there we go.
There were definitely lines in the first two episodes that were kind of like that were very clearly callbacks. So this definitely could have been.
Yeah. Any other fan service? I mean, Kayla, did you mention there was like a Gorn skeleton?
Yeah. So we haven't even talked about Lorca's creepy taxidermy room, which I will never stop calling it Lorca's creepy taxidermy room.
Yeah.
Where we see that he's kept the giant slimy space beetle from the Glen. He like beamed it over to his taxidermy room. And then we see in the background, there's like a Gorn skeleton. And that was confirmed in After Trek and on Twitter that, yes, that was a Gorn skeleton.
Yeah.
Even though officially Starfleet doesn't meet the Gorn until
Till Arena. About 12 years later. Yep.
So, don't know what's up with that, but they're Black Ops, so I guess everything they do is unofficial? I don't know. I kind of thought that was kind of dumb, and they could have left it out.
Yeah, and again, that's another reason why it's tough as a prequel to do that.
Yeah, but it's like, that really does kind of fly in the face of canon to me. It's like, oh,
completely.
But they met them unofficially, and it was a secret, and it's like, okay, but
yeah,
just don't do that.
See, they did the same thing in Voyager, though, when they to introduce Seven of Nine, where they said, oh, the Hansons were these amazing exobiologists, and they discovered the Borg years before Q discovered them.
Oh. It's like, oh, right.
Remember?
Yeah. But it's like, but no, we have the way things are supposed to be. It's called canon. It's on Memory Alpha. Look it up.
Yeah, use it.
Canon, get some.
Now, one of the things in terms of fan service and canon, and you mentioned, you know, like you can't make a show in 2017 that looks like a show from 1965, right? Or I guess 64 was when The Cage was filmed. Is we have to acknowledge the fact that our technology that we have now, in many ways, is better than the technology that Kirk and Spock had in the future, right? I mean, we can do more things with our phones than they could do with their tricorder.
Or with the computer in some cases.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, completely. We also have to acknowledge the actual real life canonical issue that, for example, in the 1990s, a Superman named Khan Noonien Singh did not try to seize control of Asia and get cast out into the universe in a ship called the Botany Bay.
Right.
I mean, that did not happen. So these are some things that there may be some issues that we just have to swallow because of reality.
Truth, yeah.
Oh, the other little fan service thing I really liked is the phaser sounds are the same as the phaser sounds for the new Trek movies.
Oh, nice. Yeah, and the phasers are similar, too, in terms of, like, the red, blue.
Yeah. Yeah, so that I liked.
Yeah. Cool. So I think that covers most of what we can talk about, I think, in this episode.
Yeah.
You know, we could talk about this for hours and I think not get much further because, as we said at the beginning, context is for kings, but I feel like I need a lot more context to really understand what's going on in this episode. So it's a very much like, here's what they laid out in front of us. All of it's dangling there. You know, it's all like bait waiting, you know, and it's like, hey, stick around, maybe see where this goes. You know, this mm-hmm. person's kind of a jerk, but he's interesting. This person's kind of cool and fun. And you like this. Oh, you don't like that aspect? Well, you don't know enough about it to say that you hate it. You know what I mean? See what we're going to mm-hmm. do with it. So, you know what? I think we are like really eager to like talk about this and like dissect it and figure out if we like it or if we hate it or we what. And it's like, you guys, this is episode 3 and effectively this is episode 1. So we just have to wait. We've got to be patient. In my opinion.
We do, as difficult as that is. But I prefer media where I need to be patient and consume it week after week than binging. And
agreed.
I said it before, I'll say it again. I love that they're releasing it this way instead of all at once.
Agreed, me too, 100%. I think it gives you more time to digest each episode.
Yeah, and it's better for people like us because then we can talk about one episode at a time rather than being expected to bring our entire life to a grinding halt. To massively binge on something and then have to discuss it all at once.
Yeah. So on that note, I think all we have to look forward to is episode 4 of Star Trek Discovery, which will come out on October 8th in the US and Canada next Sunday. And it will be titled The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry, which I don't know for sure, but may win title for the longest episode title.
I think that might be longer than For the World is Hollow.
And They've Touched the Sky. I think it might be too.
Yeah.
So, what will happen in episode 4?
I suspect that will be a Saru heavy episode.
I would like that. Do you think we'll see Michael Burnham more?
Well, I sure hope so.
She was only in every single scene in this last, except for maybe one in episode 3.
Oh, yeah, except for the scene at the end, yeah.
So,
I suspect we will.
Hopefully, we're settling in now. We're going to get more to the sci-fi stories. So far, it's been a lot of character development. It's been almost more of a soap opera in space, just in terms of the, you know, it's just all about characters, which isn't a bad thing. But I'm hoping we're going to get a little more science and a little more sci-fi and maybe inching ever closer towards that ridiculously high level of optimism that I crave.
Sure, and let's hope that a grittier, darker, deadlier hairy mud doesn't come in the way of that.
Amen. Maybe we'll meet him next week.
We can probably check on IMDb to see. I don't know when he'll appear, but, you know, eventually.
Eventually.
We got plenty of stuff to look forward to.
That's for sure.
How many more episodes are there before it goes into hiatus until January?
Well, we do have all of the episodes, everything we know about all the episodes is on our Discovery page, so trekmovie.com/discovery. And so we've listed all the dates that we do know. The last one is episode 8, which airs November 5th, and then there's a hiatus after that episode. So November 5th will be the last of season 1.0, as it were.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Kayla, it's been great to spend some time chatting with you about this. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoy doing these episodes. And be sure to like, share, and subscribe, blah, 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 blah. Let us know what you think. Share any ideas you have in our comment section.
We do love hearing from you guys.
We do. We do. We absolutely do. Hopefully we can get more Trek anecdotes from you guys that we're able to share. because that makes our community a little more collaborative, which we love. And I guess we'll just talk to you again next week.
All right. See you next week, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.